This is the Tax Update Podcast for August the 4th, 2008. This week, I wish that hadn't worked. Taxpayers ruled correct the first time. The Tax Update Podcast, intended for tax professionals, is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners respect their own research and confirm minds raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the audio document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such prohibited use from inclusion of the podcast or document is part of the CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg.services. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineberg.services.com. This week, we're going to revisit a case that we first looked at back in November of 2006 when it made its way through the tax court. This is the case of Cadillac versus Commissioner 127 TC number 13. Now, Mr. Cadillac wasn't happy with the decision of the tax court, so he appealed this decision to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And this week, the Ninth Circuit ruled, and unfortunately for Mr. Cadillac, it affirmed a tax court decision in this matter. Now, the issue involved for Mr. Cadillac a couple of matters. The key one we're going to look at this week, though, is his Section 83B election and its impact on his return, and review again what the 83B election means and the potential issues that we run into with those elections. In order to have some context, you've got to remember what the world was like back in the latter part of the last decade and the beginning of this one to understand why Mr. Cadillac would have, as he did in the year 2000, volunteered to have paid a substantial amount of tax that it later turned out he was unable to pay when the stock price came crashing down. The end of the last decade and into the beginning of this one, we had the dot-com boom. Stock prices on technology companies were rising rapidly. Employees working for those companies were often granted stock options as compensation. That compensation, because the value of the stock kept increasing, could be significant. And because the value kept on going up, the employees tended to feel the company could only go up in value. Now, as we discovered later on, that wasn't exactly the best assumption to make, but it was one a lot of people were making at that time, and a lot of taxpayers ended up doing what Mr. Cadillac ends up doing in this case, and that is making an 83B election to try to keep from having the, what would be sure to happen, future appreciation be taxed at a lower rate or potentially defer that tax for quite a while if we didn't sell the stock. And why would we ever sell the stock? Because it obviously will never go down but keep increasing at hundreds of percent increases per year. Or at least that was the thought at the time. Mr. Cadillac had a set of incentive stock options that he received from his employer. As everyone knew back then, the stocks only went up rapidly in value over time, and Mr. Cadillac likely believed that every day he held off exercising his stock options, the spread between the value of his shares and his exercise price would continue to grow. In reality, that had been happening since he had been given those options back in 1998 through the year 2000 when he finally exercised them. Since that spread would be subject to alternative minimum taxation as ISO shares, now we don't tax them for regular tax purposes, but we do tax them for AMT purposes, he wanted to have that event occur as soon as possible for the spread so that he wouldn't be paying tax on this rapid increase that's happening in the future to the shares. Mr. Cadillac, therefore, exercised options even though he was not fully vested in all the options he exercised, and if he left employment, whether voluntary or not, before such time as the shares vested, he would only be paid back the amount he paid for them. He had to surrender them to the employer, and he would only get back the exercise price. Now, even though the exercise price was the price of the shares on the date the options were granted, due to the rapid increase, it was significantly worth more than his exercise price at the date he actually exercised the shares. Now, why do we have that situation? Well, because Section 83 comes into play. And the default of Section 83 under Section 83A is that if we receive an exchange for services property for which there exist restrictions at that date, we don't value the shares or we ignore, you know, we basically do not, we have to reduce the value by those restrictions. So at that point, we don't include in his income the value of the shares because he may not get to keep the appreciation. The appreciation is not his, and it's subject to a substantial restriction. He can't transfer the shares, he can't do anything with them, and he may turn around and have to forfeit that back. However, there's an election available to taxpayers who, after seeing that, and this often happens with restricted stocks, sometimes happens with closely held companies where we have stocks that are subject to restrictive repurchase agreements for a time period because we're trying to lock the employee in. We can make an election under Section 83B to ignore the restrictions and pick up the full fair value of the stock immediately. Why do we want to do that? Because if we don't do that, we will still pick up that spread and that differential in AMT income, but we'll pick it up when the restrictions finally lapse. Again, if the value of that stock is going to continue to increase rapidly in the future, there is little reason for us to want to put that off and suddenly have it go from being paying tax on, in Mr. Cadillac's case, was around $3 million. And if the stock continued to increase that it had the previous couple of years, he could have been looking at $10 million of income. Well, we prefer to pay tax on 3 rather than 10. So in that case, we can make the election under Section 83B to include the full fair value of the property at that time in our income. That election under Section 83B2 has to be made no later than 30 days after the date of the transfer. And the election cannot be revoked without the consent of the IRS. Now, to describe how to make this election and the consequences and how we could get out of this election, the IRS has issued regulations under Section 83. The taxpayer makes the election by following the requirements in Section 1.83-2 of the regulations. As noted in the code, the election must be made no later than 30 days after the transfer, though it can be made before the transfer per Regulation 1.83-2B. Now, no IRS form exists to make this election. Rather, it's a plain paper election, as many regulatory elections are, but with a bit of a twist. We have to give copies of this election to the IRS and to the vendor or the entity from which we gave our services, generally the employer, within that 30-day time frame to lock it down. As well, we have to provide with our return a copy of the election that we have made under Section 83. The requirements are found in Section 83.2 C and D. C tells us the manner of making the election, which is we file one copy of the written statement with the IRS office where we are going to file our return for the year. As well, we have to give one copy of the statement to the person who transferred the property, generally our employer. That second one's important because the employer now gets to, in cases other than this AMT situation quite often, if it's for regular tax purposes, would trigger the deduction. As well, additional copies shall be provided right to the person who the services are performed. That's Section 1.83-2D. And we give it with our tax return. Now, those are the requirements. Now, it's an interesting question the regs don't answer as to what happens if we fail to do one of the three. My own take on that is if you fail to execute all three, you've got an IRS and a heads I win, tails you lose situation. That is, the IRS can argue if it's in their best interest that the election is invalid because you failed to follow through as required by the regulations. But I don't believe it's going to be possible to convince the IRS that if you decided by the time it came around to file the return that the election wasn't a good idea, and in Mr. Cadillac's case, it became pretty clear, most likely by the following April 15th, that this election was not such a wonderful idea, that you could just fail to include the election with your return and get out of it. Doubt that's going to work as well, since the election is not supposed to be one you can get out of. The content of the election is found in Regulation 1.83-2E. And it provides generally that you have to provide the name, address, and taxpayer identification number of the taxpayer. You have to describe the property with which the election is being made, the date or dates the property is transferred in the taxable year for which the election is being made, the nature of the restrictions or restrictions to which the property is subject, the fair market value of the time of transfer with respect to which the election is being made without regard to any restriction, the amount you paid for such property, and with respect to any election made after July 21st, 1978, which would be the vast majority of anything we're going to be dealing with these days, unless you have some 30-year-old issues you're playing with, a statement to the effect that copies have been furnished to the persons described in paragraph D, that is, to the employer or the service provider or the service recipient if you were a contract labor situation in that scenario. The election cannot be undone without the consent of the IRS and must be conditioned upon a mistake of fact, and the request must be made within 60 days of the date the mistake of fact becomes known to the taxpayer who made the election. Now, I should note in quickly correcting what I just said, not correcting, but enhancing, that in fact this also would apply to an individual who received a partnership interest in exchange for services. Any property, partnership interest counts as well, can be subject to an 83B election if there are restrictions, and we waive those. However, there's an important negative consequence of making an 83B election. It's found at the end of Section 83B, and that is noted that if the property is subsequently forfeited, no deduction shall be allowed with respect to such forfeiture. So if we forfeit the property and therefore we gave it back, in Mr. Cadillac's case, we give it back at a loss, we are not going to be able to claim that loss on our tax return. We picked up the income and paid tax on the income, but we later turns out we don't get to keep that income, or we don't get to keep the full value of what we had been given. We don't get to go back and claim a loss on that disposition. That's a significant negative, because had we just let the regular course of Section 83A go forward, once we have it included in our income, we essentially will not have, we will get full basis, and any gains or losses would be allowed at that point. Now, Mr. Cadillac's facts, we're going to take a look at those, and it's a quick review of the facts we first discussed back in November 2006, the first podcast we did on Mr. Cadillac's case. He worked for Ariba Technologies at the time, a company whose stock, like that of many technology companies at the time, had been rapidly increasing in value over the years. In fact, the appreciation had occurred fairly consistently from 1998, when he was first granted the options, through April of 2000, when he exercised them. At the time he exercised the option, he would not become fully vested unless he remained employed with Ariba Technologies through February of 2002. If no 83B election was made, he would have picked up the AMT adjustment each year as the restrictions lapsed. If the shares kept skyrocketing, and they had gone up quite a bit, the shares when they were given to him, when he was offered the option, were worth $3,002. Now they were worth over $3 million at the date of exercise, so it was a significantly increasing value of stock over a relatively short period of time, just 2 years. If that continued to happen, he would be paying on that increased value in the future years as the restrictions lapse. So in 2001 and 2002, he would pick up the spread as the shares became vested. And that spread, if the stock kept on its meteoric rise that it had had from 1998 through 2000, could be very substantial, probably in the tens of millions by the time we were done, or even more. Mr. Cadillac, looking at that, decided that paying tax on $3 million, or basically in this case, the amount that was AMT involved, which was just over $680,000, represented the spread on the restricted shares, that paying tax on $680,000 looked a lot better than paying tax on $20 million. So he'd pay tax on $680,000 today, and most likely in his mind, that meant he wouldn't pay tax on $20 million over the next 2 years. At the date he exercised the shares, they were worth $3.2 million, while his exercise price, as mentioned, was just over $3,000. He incurred a very substantial alternative minimum tax liability for the year 2000, tax that would have been due on his tax return on April 15th of 2001. Unfortunately, it turned out the future wasn't quite as bright for a lot of technology companies, a lot of employees of those companies, as 2000 came to an end and we went into 2001. And that was doubly true for Mr. Cadillac and Ariba Technologies. In May of 2001, his employment was terminated by Ariba Technologies. The non-vested shares were purchased by Ariba Technologies for $642, and the other shares were sold by Mr. Cadillac to third parties at that point. In both cases, the shares sold for far less than the $3 million that he had originally that they had been worth on date of exercise. The shares he sold to Ariba obviously just went back at what he had paid for them, but he didn't get proportionately the equivalent of millions of dollars from the sale of his Ariba shares later. But he had paid AMT tax on that rapid appreciation, or he had been assessed it, shall we say. One part of his problem at the moment was, like many people in that position, it turns out the assets he was relying upon to be able to pay the tax no longer existed or were basically worthless. The 83B election had caused him to recognize $680,000 of AMT income on the shares that he would eventually be forced to forfeit in May of 2001. He later decided, finding that he didn't have the resources available to pay that 2000 tax liability due to the crash in the stock price, to amend his 2000 return and claim the amount should not have been included in his income. Or, alternatively, he should get a break on it. He had two theories under which he would try to avoid the negative consequences of his 83B election. In the first theory, he argued his 83B election was not valid, as what he received was not property under California law and the regulations for Section 83, and that Section 83 only applies to property. Or he was entitled to a claim of right deduction under Section 1341 upon forfeiture of the non-vested shares, generating a credit equal to the tax that had been imposed in the year 2000 based upon the spread on those shares. He had a third argument as well that was coming forward. This was the argument that, in fact, for AMT purposes, the $3,000 a year capital loss limitation did not apply, and that the loss generated from the resale of the AMT shares also generated an AMT net operating loss. We're not going to consider that issue here, but realize that he fared no better than the taxpayer in Merlo versus Commissioner, 126 TC number 10, who lost his appeal to the Fifth Circuit. We had a podcast on that back in May of 2006, where we discussed the fact that the $3,000 limitation was held by the tax court in that case to apply. The Ninth Circuit indicates they agree as well here. The $3,000 limitation applies. So now we have two circuits endorsing the tax court's position that, in fact, for AMT purposes, the $3,000 capital loss limitation applies, and this is not a net operating loss generating transaction for AMT purposes. But let's get back to the Section 83 problem for Mr. Cadillac. Mr. Cadillac argued his 83B election was ineffective since what he received didn't conform to the definition of property. The Ninth Circuit panel explained his position this way: that Cadillac does not take issue with the tax court reasoning that the benefits he received upon acquiring the non-vested shares, including his acquisition of all stockholders' rights and his entitlement to receive all regular dividends, constitute a beneficial interest under Section 83. Instead, he points out that a beneficial interest in asset is not alone sufficient. Such a beneficial interest to be property, the assets must have been transferred or set aside from the claims of creditors per Treasury Regulation 1.83-3E. Now, he then set forth an interesting theory about why, in fact, in his situation, these escrowed shares had not been set aside from the claims of creditors. In that regard, the court notes, Mr. Cadillac argues that merely depositing his non-vested shares to an escrow account did not adequately protect them from the claim of his employer's creditors. He speculates that if Ariba had filed for bankruptcy, its creditors could have forced it to terminate Cadillac's at-will employment and exercise its right to repurchase his non-vested shares at cost. He further likens an escrow account to a rabbi trust and argues that the doctrine of constructive receipt does not require recognition of income under Section 83, where deferred compensation is subject to substantial limitations or restrictions, including the claims of the creditors of the corporation. On the first issue, the Ninth Circuit didn't agree with the outline of his theoretical creditor could seize and then force Mr. Cadillac to be fired theory, but concluded that it didn't bring about the results he had claimed. The court noted, we have no quarrel with Cadillac's hypothesis. Given the terms of Cadillac's employment contract and the Ariba stock plan, it is conceivable the creditors of a bankrupt Ariba could force it to terminate Cadillac and then repurchase his non-vested shares at cost. But Cadillac misses the point, as the scenario he envisions only incidentally involves the claims of Ariba's creditors. The real culprits are Ariba's rights of termination and purchase, which Ariba could exercise of its own accord any time and for any reason, regardless of any financial difficulty or pressure from creditors. Viewed in that light, Cadillac's hypothesis demonstrates nothing more than his non-vested shares were subject to a substantial risk of forfeiture and therefore would ordinarily be excluded from income under Section 83A, not that they were outside the scope of Section 83 altogether. As the very purpose of a taxpayer's 83B election is to realize income on assets that otherwise would not be included in income under Section 83A due to a substantial risk of forfeiture, the mere fact an asset is due to a substantial risk of forfeiture is no justification either for excluding it from the definition of property and the coverage of Section 83 or invalidating an otherwise valid Section 83B election. Therefore, the theoretical creditor, shall we say in this case, ended up only with the rights that Ariba already had to terminate Mr. Cadillac's services, rather than having a direct right to seize the assets from the escrow account, a right that would have existed only at the time that the creditor took over the company. That's the more traditional view that we would find in a traditional non-qualified deferred compensation arrangement, where the company still is under a full obligation to pay the employee or former employee, but the creditor has a right to seize the assets and use those assets against its claims, use the assets to basically pay off its debts, pay off the debts of the company to it. Now, the panel had even less regard for his alternative like a rabbi trust theory. The court noted, also without merit, is Cadillac's suggestion that even aside from Ariba's light of repurchase, depositing the non-vested shares into an escrow account was insufficient to satisfy Treasury Regulation Section 1.83-3E. Despite Cadillac's manifest and repeated misquotation of the regulation in his briefs, the regulation quite plainly enumerates a trust or escrow account as the prototypical vehicles for transferring or setting aside from the assets from the claims of creditors. Moreover, even if Cadillac might be correct that certain types of trust or escrow accounts could fail to satisfy the regulatory requirement, because he has provided no evidence that the escrow account used by Ariba was in fact inadequate to protect his shares from Ariba's creditors, we have no reason to depart from the general rule in this case. Thus, the election was held to be valid, and he had to live with the 83B election in 2000. But he had an alternative way of getting at the same result, he hoped. And that would be to claim that under the claim of right doctrine of Section 1341, that he could use that to recalculate the 2000 tax, thus attempting to recover what he otherwise couldn't get access to or what he had created with his 83B election. The claim of right doctrine under Section 1341 allows for special treatment where a taxpayer includes an item in income in 1 year, but the taxpayer later has to pay back that income. If the amount exceeds $3,000, rather than having to accept only a deduction in the year of forfeiture, the taxpayer can get a credit by recalculating the tax for the year in inclusion. Three conditions are outlined for a claim of right and are found in Section 1341A. That provides that if an item was included in gross income for a prior taxable year or years because it appeared the taxpayer had an unrestricted right, and secondly, a deduction is allowable for the taxable year because it was established after the close of such prior taxable year or years, the taxpayer did not have an unrestricted right to such item or portion of such item, and the amount of such deduction exceeds $3,000, then we trigger Section 1341's special treatment. Mr. Cadillac clearly had an item that was included in income in 2000. The amount also clearly exceeded $3,000. And it was established after the year end that he did not have a right to retain the income. So it looks great for him, right? So far, so good. We should be in great shape and we can use Section 1341 to recompute what tax would have been due in 2000 and then use that as a credit. Well, not so fast. The Ninth Circuit points out there's a little clause in there that he's glancing over. And that says a deduction is allowable for the taxable year. That's at the start of Section 1341A2. The panel notes that Section 1341 indeed permits taxpayers to compute their tax differently where they report income on the receipt of property in one tax year and then forfeited that property in a later tax year. But the statute applies only if a deduction is allowable, and the court emphasized that in the text, for the taxable year because it was established after the close of such prior taxable year or years, the taxpayer did not have an unrestricted right to such items or a portion of such item, among the other requirements of Section 1341A2. As clarified in the accompanying regulation, the deduction must be allowable under other provisions of the tax code, Treasury Regulation 1.1341A1. In this case, Cadillac fails to satisfy the 1341A2 because the flush language of Section 83B1 expressly disallows any deduction respecting the forfeiture of his non-vested shares that were made subject to a valid Section 83B election. The statute plainly states if such election is made and if such property is subsequently forfeited, no deduction shall be allowed in respect of such forfeitures, Section 83B1. The court noted that he rather had to live with the calculation under Section 1.83-2A, a calculation that's going to result in a net gain or loss of zero. As the court notes, besides being ineligible for a claim of right deduction under Section 1341, his deduction was also limited under Treasury Regulation 1.83-2A to the excess, if any, of the amount paid for the shares over the amount realized upon the forfeiture. Of course, as Ariba repurchased the shares at cost, there was no excess and therefore no deduction. What's our conclusion here? Well, we're revisiting this because it's useful to remember that many tax elections and strategies have downside when the future doesn't pan out as the taxpayer expects. And in recent years, we've had clients that believed without that and couldn't be dissuaded from believing that various investments simply could not go down in value. In the late 1990s, that was stocks, especially technology stocks, could not go down in value. It was impossible. So any talk to them about a bad idea for the strategy because the stock might go down, well, that was just crazy talk. And then in the middle of this decade, residential real estate was similarly deemed to be such a perfect magic investment asset that couldn't go down in value. And again, any cautions related to a tax strategy that presumed that the real estate value would continue to increase was also deemed to be crazy talk. And I'm sure we'll find something else in the future because speculative bubbles do tend to come and go. As advisors, we need to be aware, we need to be the voice of reason and consider and make sure the client's aware of all the what-ifs that may occur if their situation doesn't come forward. As well, it's not a bad idea to give historical perspective and point out to clients that things that seem like sure things and that everyone knew was a sure thing later turned out to be not so sure, and that some people ended up in very bad tax situations or other financial situations after presuming that they were going to be able to, that they knew the future, and that by knowing the future, they knew what to do. It also is relevant to note that this is another problem where we let the tax situation drive us. In the case of the AMT shares, if we'd exercise shares only when the shares in question were vested, and if we had immediately disqualified them, or we disqualified them before the end of the year in which we had exercised the shares, we could avoid the very nasty situation a lot of taxpayers got into where the AMT shares went down in value before the tax was due. They couldn't sell the shares. Again, you wanted to usually hold them for 1 year because you needed to do that to keep from disqualifying and having to pick up ordinary income, and you got long-term capital gain treatment. But the danger with that was if they didn't go up, you may not have the cash to pay the tax at the end of the day. And at the beginning of this decade, a number of people that work for technology firms found that to be the case. Now, this has been the tax update. I'm going to be doing some traveling in the near future. I've got 2 days coming up in Missouri later this month, 1 day on IRS practice and procedures, 1 day on the partnership taxation, pass-through taxation, advanced concepts for taxation of partnerships and LLCs. If you're in the St. Louis area coming up here the 13th and 14th of this month, go ahead and take a look at the Missouri Society of CPAs website and consider signing up for the courses. I also have a link on my main page now to the courses I will be doing in the future. I've got them coming in a number of states coming up as we go into the last half of this year. As always, the Tax Update podcast is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Be sure to visit them and consider subscribing to their email newsletters for information of interest to tax professionals. This has been the Tax Update.